This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. And joining us now is Tony Leah. And Tony, I always slightly get your title wrong. So tell us who your position.
Hi, Phil. I'm the chairperson of the Unifor Local 222 Political Action Committee. And so in that role, the committee is able to think about and raise political issues that should be important to the workers who are members of the local in the Oshawa area. So I think that it's a useful role that everybody in the committee plays.
Now, you were part, of course, of this great struggle of trying to get justice from General Motors when they went into their shutdown pre-pandemic. It's kind of like almost a biblical marking point. An individual who came and gave time and effort and spoke very compellingly for the cause and raised the issue for the group that came to be known as Green Jobs Oshawa was Dimitri Lascaris, who was went on to be, and maybe at that time was, a candidate for the leadership of the Green Party. And since we're talking about parties and how, whether people should join them and follow them and all that, we all hoped, I'm sure, that Lascaris, being a real sincere individual, we hoped that he would, win out in a contest. He ran for leadership of the Green. And I know you've been following this, that they chose
Enemy Paul.
And the party is now in a very odd state. I noticed that they give you a sort of sample. I have a headline from the last Wednesday's Toronto Star. Green Party expresses widespread dismay over leader. I think we could also say that the Globe and Mail, CBC, Toronto Star, CTV, they're rather dismaying themselves in the coverage of this. Really, we're watching a kind of political tragedy unfold. And Eve Engler, I know, has written a piece about this. I know you've thought about it. Could you tell us something not unknown in parties? That is, that the sort of the party regularly selected leadership of the party, the ones who have to look after paying the bills and getting the buildings and organizing the campaigns, and that's their full-time job, and also guaranteeing that the party carries out the mandate that the members gave it. There has been a sharp and nasty fight. And we heard there was going to be some kind of a review. So I'll let you pick up the story. What happened to that? I read the headline saying that's going to be dropped, and it was announced by the leader. So can you talk about it?
I think it's a really important issue. I would say that Enemy Paul in many ways is actually attacking the Green Party. She's leading a fight against her own party, including a legal battle. And it's primarily because the Green Party was the first major political party in Canada to adopt a forthright policy supporting the Palestinians and opposing Israeli occupation of territories and illegal settlements, and calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And the adoption of that policy was, to a great extent, the really heroic work of Dimitri Lascaris. And he fought for that. And eventually that policy was adopted in a referendum by 91% of the members of the Green Party. It was a widely popular policy, and it probably would be widely popular amongst Canadians, but it's, you know, the leaders of political parties don't want to touch that. And even after the policy was adopted by the Green Party, there were, of course, people who wanted to undermine that. And Annamie Paul, when she was elected leader, clearly was heading in that direction. And the particular incident that sparked the current debacle, chaos within the party, came about when the Israeli government again unleashed its attacks on Gaza and were bombing the people of Gaza, civilians in Gaza. And Annamie Paul did not reflect the policy of the Green Party, but made a compromising kind of political statement, which was criticized by two of the three MPs who represent the Green Party in Parliament. And when they did that, Annamie Paul's advisor, a guy named Noah Zatzman, posted a message on Facebook, which was virulent. And people taught, you know, people will mention that all of this controversy surrounds him, but most of the time they don't print what he actually said because it is just so bad. And I want to read what he posted on Facebook. He said, "Appalling anti-Semitism and discrimination from a range of political actors, beginning with Jagmeet Singh and Dimitri Lascaris and many liberal NDP and sadly Green MPs. We will not accept an apology after you realize what you've done. We will work to defeat you and bring in progressive climate champions who are Antifa and pro-LGBT and pro-Indigenous sovereignty and Zionists." So it was that statement which caused the conflict, because he was calling for the defeat of their own members of parliament and calling them anti-Semites. And Annamie Paul refused to comment on that. She didn't disavow him. She didn't fire him. She didn't say this is a flagrant violation of our policy. She said nothing. And so the whole controversy has been from members of the party asking Annamie Paul to disavow this virulent anti-Palestinian racist who was speaking on her behalf as her advisor.
Exactly. By the way, you know, if we're just talking about plain political leadership, if you have an advisor and they write like that, it's automatic. You just simply are dismissed, or you really cravenly apologize. But in this case, I mean, that's, I was struck by that. And on that level, we're just, it's almost as though we're talking about ineptitude. Don't they understand that an ordinary member understands that if you're the executive assistant and you say something really insulting about a fellow member, that's not, you got the wrong job. If you have these opinions, you really ought not to be around the leader.
That's why I'm saying that Annamie Paul has actually gone to war against her own party, because the leadership of the party, they have a federal council that constitutionally is supposed to represent the members. And that federal council asked her to disavow Zatzman, and she wouldn't do it. And at that point, they felt compelled to say that her leadership needed to be reviewed. And her response was behind closed doors, hidden from the membership of the Green Party. She had her lawyers bring a legal case against the Green Party behind closed doors, and was able to get an arbitrator who was not, as it turns out, a fair judge of the issues, somebody who was already partisan, coincidentally or not, to issue an order on her supporting Annamie Paul, but also gagging the party and telling them they couldn't talk about the fact that he'd issued an order. And he issued an order saying that they were not allowed to proceed with the review of her membership or of her leadership. And
Can I ask you there? I mean, isn't this is the sort of thing which this is Canada, very proud of itself as having opposition parties and whatnot. Gross interference. This strikes me as gross interference in the inner workings of a party. Something that is, you know, by an arbitrator who begins to give the party orders, right?
That is right. And the party, the Federal Council, is appealing that decision on exactly those grounds, that the arbitrator has no authority to order the political party. The political party has to operate according to its constitution and bylaws and code of conduct, which, by the way, are federal matters. And the arbitrator is a provincial arbitrator. And the pretext that Annamie Paul used was that she said she was arbitrating her employment contract with the Green Party of Canada Fund, the body which signed a contract with her and has authority to pay her, which is not the Green Party. The Green Party was not even a signatory to that employment contract, which is another grounds of appeal. The other thing that has, you know, that Annamie Paul is trying to cover up is that she violated a fundamental principle of the code of conduct of Green Party members by taking legal action against her own party. And I want to read you what it says in their members' code of conduct. It says, the executive director will automatically initiate a membership review if a member initiates legal proceedings against the party. So once Annamie Paul had initiated legal proceedings against the Green Party, they were obligated to automatically review her membership. And she tried to play that as that she was being a victim of you know, people trying to kick her out of her party unfairly. Her actions required the party to initiate that review.
Yes. You know, it's like the Green Party went out of its way to shoot itself in the foot, because the conduct I'm witnessing from Annamie Paul and her executive assistant, whom she to this day refuses to say anything about, and also her reactions, highly subjective reactions. My understanding is she accused people of racism and anti-Semitism and sexism. She didn't leave out many things to accuse people of. She strikes me as someone who is a political neophyte, this is simply not how, if you want to build a party in an organization, you cannot talk that way. You have to be reaching out. One of the things I notice is that everybody says, reach out. She's never reached anybody. But this is becoming a kind of a wider issue. Incidentally, the article we're referring to, you can find several, there's a mainstream pressman, and eveangler.com, far right. This is where I want to go with it. Far right rallies behind Annamie Paul, and he points out that other parties, and I'm sure you notice this, the media seems to be trying to figure out how this can help some other people, other parties. And according to Eve Engler's article, the National Post or the Toronto Sun was suggesting that the leader of the Conservative Party should promise to give her a cabinet seat if he wins. What do you make of that?
I think it's very remarkable, but I think it underlies the point I was trying to make before, which is that the real issue here is the policy in support of Palestinians that Enemy Paul is opposed to, and that these other right-wing parties are opposed to, and they're all combining because they feel a need to try to undermine or destroy that policy which has been adopted by the Green Party of Canada members. Mm-hmm. As in many other cases, you know, the right-wing leadership is prepared to destroy their own party in the interests of undermining progressive politics and people who support the Palestinians. And really, it's parallel to what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. The right wing in the Labour Party was prepared to destroy the party, wanted the party to lose the election so that they could get rid of Jeremy Corbyn and leaders who supported the Palestinians. And I think that's what Enemy Paul is doing, and that's why the right wingers are supporting her.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting historical trend, according to George Galloway, who follows this much more closely because they have large Green parties in Europe. He said almost all of them began with these high principles and caring about the environment and trying to save the planet, et cetera. And he said it didn't take long before they all became enthusiastic about NATO. And they began to take strange positions on immigration. And he said they've gone, many or most of them, to the right. They probably ought to re-examine their ideology. One of the things I notice is that the Globe and others have been doing a kind of tut-tut in speaking to Enemy Paul. They say, you know, it's too bad she's beleaguered by people talking about Palestine. They've got to get back to their real, and she says it, bread and butter, you know, this is our issue. But I didn't hear anybody say anything negative about her when she accused China of genocide and called on a movement, an international political movement, to take the Winter Olympics away from China, and accused them of genocide against the Uyghurs. And nobody said, gee, aren't you a little far from home with this issue? But she was on that issue. To my mind, they should have called her to account for that. The bottom line on that is, maybe, and I'd like you to weigh in on this as well. If the issue is save the planet and let's get ourselves a green agenda and et such, clearly, none of that is achievable without multilateralism, international cooperation, and an ironclad commitment to peaceful resolution of differences. These countries that she is talking about and taking sides with, involved, many of them are nuclear station countries. And when you talk about picking a fight with a major power, if you care about the planet, you ought to take your tone, ought to be reduced a little bit, a little respect shown. And somebody ought to say, look, let's work for peace, because we have to have peace in order to have cooperation to save the planet. That's my, I
couldn't agree with you more. And I would like to point out that Dimitri Lascaris did champion that kind of an outlook when he ran for leader of the Green Party. That was part of the reason for his forthright support for Green Jobs Oshawa when we were calling for nationalization of General Motors. It was understanding that a socialist outlook, Dimitri calls himself an eco-socialist, is fundamental to solving these problems. We're not going to solve these problems under a capitalist system where everything is directed to private profit and imperialism and warmongering. And we're not going to achieve peace or climate justice in that kind of a system. And Dimitri won over 40% of the votes in the leadership contest. So this is a real battle within the Green Party, as I'm sure it would be in other parties, right? But there's a strong group of people that do have, I think, a much more progressive position, which would be in line with wanting international peace and solidarity and cooperation, which is really the only way forward.
Yeah, that's a voice, Tony Leo, a Unifor veteran and labor writer. Tony, and I really like that point. I mean, about bringing up Dimitri, and there were other Green Party people also beginning to say that. I assume that the alarm bells were ringing in the headquarters of the old gang who dominated the party for so long. But they are definitely in a fight for their very soul at the moment. Another matter I want to raise with you, because I know you study the labor movement from top to bottom and from its beginnings. I have an item here from a former, actually his name is Stephen, I get this right, Stephen Greenhouse, and he is the former New York Times labor reporter. And I think you'll like the title. He has a book titled Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor, and it's in paperback. But here's, he had a tweet that says the following: crazy that Frito-Lay workers had to go on strike nearly 3 weeks just to win the right not to have to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now they can, quotes, only be forced to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, going from 84 hours a week to 72 hours. Sounds like a 19th century labor victory. What do you make of that, Tony?
Yeah, sadly, that is the state of the labor movement in the United States and Canada these days, that we've gone backwards. We've been pushed backwards. The labor movement has been disorganized, has been disarmed by this ideology of cooperation with companies, instead of fighting for the class, organizing the working class to fight. This idea that we have common interests with our employers has been very destructive. And it has weakened the labor movement to the point where we're seeing conditions which are 19th century and, you know.
I mean, that is 19. I mean, 12 hour shifts. Mm-hmm. And they didn't get rid of the 12 hours. Oh, they got rid of one day.
One day. You know, we had strikes in Canada for the 9 hour day in 1872.
Eleanor Marx was calling for the 8 hour day. Oh no, was it the 10 hour day in 1885?
Yeah. And workers were winning.
By the way, they won strikes. They did win it. And her lecture 2 or 3 years with a strike. We should get a law. And so that all workers, their time will be protected, and they have time with family and recover from them. Those jobs are not easy, by the way. But did you notice that this story, the Frito story, was played as a big labor victory? They said, oh boy, labor is starting to win some fights. They did? They got, they don't have to work 12-hour shifts.
Well, I'm glad that they fought and raise the issue, and that in itself, you know, is some progress. We've been through a period when workers didn't seem to be fighting about anything, but we've got a long way to go with, you know, if we've been pushed back to that point. And you know, even in unionized workplaces in North America, including within my own union, Unifor, I would have to say that it's, if you start looking at collective agreements and see what the union has agreed to, it's pretty shocking. It's routine in many collective agreements now to have far lower wages, two-tier agreements where people start at 60 or 70% of the wages of the longer-term workers doing exactly the same work. They've completely torn up the idea of equal pay for equal work, which is know, was a fundamental principle. It doesn't exist anymore. You might have to work 8 or 10 years some places before you can make the same pay as somebody else doing the same job. They've destroyed the principle of security in retirement or dignity in retirement, which was a fundamental battle of the labor movement in the 1940s and 1950s for workers to have pensions. And it's almost gone now. Workers only get, you know, some kind of retirement savings plan because it's less expensive for the companies. We have more and more part-time and temporary workers in our workplaces sanctioned by the collective agreements. So we've lost a lot. And, you know, there are some signs that workers want to fight against those things. But I think to be successful, they're really going to have to start to understand what led to the decline, what ideology has disarmed them and made them weaker.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a, they have lost the idea of a class for itself. But it didn't go away by nature. McCarthyism and the Red Scares, the Palmer Raids, et cetera, were designed to destroy the political side of the labor movement. You know, it's interesting, we're talking about the Frito thing. Why isn't there a law that you can't work 12 hours? Nobody should be working 12 hours. Everybody says it's bad for your health. I mean, it's dangerous. But it's gotten, as they say, the Campbell got his nose under the tent, and now he's in the tent. Well, we've been speaking to Tony Lee about this matter, and I will remind you, eveangler.com, you'll find the article about what's going on in the Green Party, and it is a very informative piece. I guess we'll take a break, and we'll come back with a little more of the Taylor Report.